We're going to get started. Our speaker is with us. So, Cecilia Klingel. Like Racine Danish Klingel. Welcome. Thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate it. And we'll just let you go ahead and tell us your story.
Okay. I saw that on your agenda. This is marked as a presentation. But I would feel much better if we make this more an interactive Q&A. I'll give you a little background information, and then I'm going to just open it up and let you ask me questions relevant to the work that you're doing. I agreed to come here today for several reasons. I have not disrupted an adoption. My son is about to turn 25 years old. In December, he has been with us, or was our son, it was adopted by us when he turned 11. He actually only lived in our home for about 2 years. Because I have been made aware of the fact that these proceedings are made public and publicized, and I want to protect the privacy of my family and particularly my children, I am not in this setting going to be able to go into detail about all the factors that led us to be on the verge of disruption. But I will do my best to give you some sense of what the challenges were that we faced and how we were able to overcome them in ways I think many families cannot. I would be very happy off the record at a later time to answer much more detailed questions about our family's situation if any of you have follow-up questions for me, and I'm available by email. When my family adopted our son, I was 23 years old and my husband was 24. Our son was 11. For many years, he would tell his teachers at the start of a new school year that his mom was 12 when he was born and would stop the conversation right there. When I would come in on parent-teacher conferences and the teacher would look shocked, and I would say, "He didn't tell you he's adopted, did he?" We were very young. We became foster parents immediately after graduating from the UW-Madison. At that time, we were already married and had our first child. Kateri was 8 months old when we were licensed with Dane County. Initially, we took young children and had several long-term placements of young girls around the age of our daughter who were successfully and happily reunified with their families. That was sort of our specialty. It was little girls. We also, however, held an emergency license. And wanting to be helpful, I still remember the day the phone rang. I was running out the door. We were going to be gone for a couple of days, or no, a day, I guess. And my husband said, "Come on." And I said, "No, I should get the call." And I picked it up, and it was DCFS. And they said, we have a placement. We know you'd be great. It's an 11-year-old boy, and or a 10-year-old at that time, and he's dying, and he needs to be adopted. Will you take him tomorrow?" I was 23. I'm like, "Sure, that's fine." I told my husband, who, being a good-hearted guy, I was like, "Okay then, that'll be a change." And that was how our adventure began. Our son came to us the next day. He was not, in fact, dying, as is evidenced by the fact that he's still around and doing quite well and very healthy. In fact, he had a very, very long journey through foster care. He had been placed at the age of 3. With a biological sibling, was in a home with his infant brother for 6 years. The infant brother was adopted by the family. They were unable to continue to meet our son's care needs. He then went into what was supposed to be a pre-adoptive placement that ended up needing to be very abruptly terminated. He came to us immediately thereafter, again with 24 hours notice to both him and to us of that placement. When he came, we thought his needs were medical. That was what, and we were savvy enough to ask for the record, and we read it, and it was boxes large. Medical needs were the identified problem. And in fact, he had very severe medical needs that required a lot of attention. Thankfully, as it turned out, the state of medical knowledge was advancing. And as I said, he wasn't dying. He just needed to be taught to do a lot of things. People had always expected him to die. He kept not dying. And so everything from eating to walking to going to the bathroom by himself, it turned out he could do just fine. So we were the mean parents who made him learn how to do all that, including learn to read. And he did great, and in fact, now he is no longer in a wheelchair, and he does most of his own self-care. He walks with a walker, and he graduated from high school. And is employed, I should add. So he's terrific. There were, however, in the disrupted placement, a lot of red flags that should have been followed up and warned. We didn't think to suggest that that might be a good option. So for several years, things were okay. His attachment was a concern, though he was always sort of a little detached and superficial with us. But in fact, seemed to be otherwise progressing, had some signs of attachment. We got him into therapy with at least three different therapists over the course of the year and a half he was living with us because we wanted to try to connect. Everyone seemed to say, he's fine, it must be cognitive delay, which he is a little bit of, but not a lot. In fact, he now presents mostly like a young man with cerebral palsy and is, again, a high school graduate, doing well, starting to pursue higher education. When our son was 11 and a half almost, I take that back, when he was almost 13, it became clear that there were some behavioral problems, psychiatric and behavioral in nature, that made it, let it suffice to say it was an absolutely unacceptable risk to the safety of other children in our home and to continue residing with us anymore, linked to some of the things that had happened in his prior home. I think that's adequate. By that time, we had two children biologically in our home. Our older daughter was 3, our younger daughter was 1.5. We adopted our son right around the same time that my second daughter was born. From that time on, we raised our children separately. Our son grew up, and I'll talk more about that because this is what made it possible to continue as his parents in a therapeutic foster home. And every 6 months, we had to fight tooth and nail to keep him there in a setting that was appropriate for him in the community, allowing him to go to high school and to get around-the-clock therapeutic interventions from trained foster parents who were working with young men who had similar issues to him. For years. It was supposed to be an emergency placement. At first, the county authorized it for 6 months and then talked about transferring him to an institutional setting. Our son, who, again, was at that time just transitioning to a walker from a wheelchair and has some mild cognitive delays, would have been an incredibly vulnerable person in any institutional setting. He was at high risk of victimization anywhere he went, but particularly in an institution. He did not need institutional care. And yet, as I'm sure you know, the resources for intensive therapeutic foster care are really limited. The only reason our son got the help that he needed was because we knew the system, having been foster parents, and because he had been a foster child. And that was a fact that we were able to use as leverage in pointing out the responsibility of the county in helping to secure adequate treatment. Had that not been the case, had we, thank you, engaged in an international adoption, had we been a little less savvy in our understanding of systems and system interactions, our son would not have gotten care. He either would have ended up in an institutional setting, or we would, and this was floated at some points, been forced to reunify under conditions that were not acceptable from a public safety point of view for other children in our home. I will say that when he left, there was one child in my home who required therapy for a year and periodically since then, though I will say all my children are healthy and happy, and in fact, we are now at a place in our lives where we have holidays together, everyone. That took 10 years to reach that place. And it was only possible to do safely and soundly and wisely for everyone involved, again, because of intensive services. Our son not only had a therapeutic treatment home environment with, I should add, incredibly wonderful foster parents, but then when he was 18, we knew to push for protective placement. So when he turned 18, he was able to attain a protective placement through the county. He gets services, he has staff support, so his physical, his mental health, and his behavioral needs are all met. I will say that from a safety point of view, our son is not a threat to others anymore, in part because he received intensive, specialized therapy. at times as often as twice a week, and now still at least once a month and sometimes twice. That's a long haul. He's now almost 25 years old, or 24, he is 24, almost 25 years old. So you can see that's a lot of services. Now there's services that have led him to become a productive contributing member of our community, that have allowed our children to all, whatever their ages be healthy and thriving. And I would say that our outcome was a happy one. What was not happy was the degree to which we had to fight for services during a time when our family was undergoing incredible trauma. Having tried to do something that we thought was going to help the children of this community, we ended up feeling like we'd hurt our own children. And maybe our son as well. The way he was raised was certainly not typical. And I will say to this day, it's always weird when people ask me how many children I have. Sometimes I give different answers depending on who I'm with and how much I'm explaining I want to do, right? Sometimes I say 7, sometimes I say 8, because yeah, there were more later. But it's awkward, right? We have much more of a, we are technically guardians, and we have much more of a guardianship, big brother, big sister relationship with our son than a parental one. However, I will say that, and our son has said this, and his whole team, I think, would support this. It is really important, even when you have to come up with odd configurations to give children permanency, it is really important to give them that permanency. Our son, no matter how weird his situation, no matter how many people he was calling mom or dad at a given time, has a family. And it has been important to his healing and his ability to really grow and flourish, to have a family, even if it's not kind of the family a kid dreams about or a parent imagines. We're still a family. And to be able to say, even when we were trying to do the parent two families at once thing and visit him once a week and keep up connections that way, when something happens in his life, he has someone to call. On holidays, he has people to be with. Right? And even when we weren't all able to be together, my husband's family would always make sure that Kenny has never been alone, right, on holidays. That's important. And when people enter into special needs adoptions, there need to be support for unanticipated developments along the way. Medical developments, we saw that. We saw all sorts of medical needs. We were prepared. We made sure insurance was covered. We made sure that we read up on his condition. We knew more about it than most people in the world, I think. We knew every specialist in this country who was working on the disease that he has. All of that we were prepared for. We were not prepared for the things that hadn't been disclosed. Right? And the reality is, as all of us who have kids know, you're never prepared for your kids, right? They're always going to have things come up that you didn't think were on the list. One thing that concerns me about disruption and the media portrayal of disruption is that every time I see a story on adoption disruption, it makes it look like parents got a kid they didn't like and threw them in the trash bin. That's not the stories that I hear from people. And I know that immediately after what happened, what led to my son having to leave our home, when we were still fighting over whether the county was going to continue any appropriate placement for him beyond a 6-month term, I was scared. Oh, I'm emotional now. Mm. It's 23 years old. 24 by then. Yeah, 24, 25 by the time he left. Right? I was young. And I wanted to keep my kids safe. All of them. Him, my girls, everybody. That was a scary thing. And I remember thinking, maybe we're the wrong people for this job. Maybe somebody else would be way better. And there aren't resources, right? I think people go to the internet. They go to people they know who know somebody in the adoption community because they don't know what to do. And the normal channels shut down. Nobody wanted to talk to me at that time at DCFS because I knew what I was asking for, something that was really, really, really expensive. I remember at one point having a conversation, and I will not name the social worker, but I appreciated her honesty. She was a very well-respected, very experienced social worker. And I was talking to her in my living room about what had happened. And I said, gosh, I feel like maybe we could have been better prepared. We could have been trained or something, I don't know. And what she said to me, which was exactly right, was, Cecilia, people come to our information sessions for foster care. And we give them this much information, and we lose 75% of them. What do you think would happen if we told them everything? But she was right. That's exactly right. The fact is that the need is far, far greater than the ability to match it. And what you have are very well-intentioned, very good-hearted people who want to serve, and their abilities are here. And the needs in the community and among the children are up here. And if I'm a social worker who just has to find a bed for a kid to sleep in, I don't go like this to make my matches, I go like this. And so parents are being asked to meet needs that they are not equipped to do. This is one of the reasons I think you see so much burnout. It's one of the reasons why, unfortunately, as you know, rates in care are high, abuse rates are higher than they are in parental homes. And that has a lot that probably goes well beyond the scope of your committee, right? In terms of the importance of wraparound services and supporting birth families, but supporting adoptive families where they exist too. Because disruption often just perpetuates the problem, right? It's very similar to the same dynamics you see when you disrupt a birth family, right? That you create more trauma for the child, you create trauma for a family, where often it didn't need to exist. Right? And the reality is, with needs up here, there have to be services that fill the gap between the abilities of the families and the needs of the children. Quite aside from our disruption, there was at least one point where, because again, we were young, but we were informed, we were interested, we were capable foster parents. I was at one point effectively running a group home. I had a child in my home for whom I had to alarm every door in my house. That should not have occurred, right? I said yes because we wanted to help. And we kept people safe during that time as best we could. But the reality was that was a kind of match that should never have been made. And it was only necessitated by the lack of services to fill in the gap. Now, it's your job to figure out how exactly you're going to come up with the resources to do that in a world that is not resource rich. But from a parental perspective, I think that's the dynamic I see in what happened to us and what I see happen to other families. And I think that to the degree you're able to destigmatize the need to seek services, to say, I can't do any more than this, I think you're going to decrease both disruptions and abuse. Because it's people who are out of options, who are at their wits' end, who don't know what to do, who don't seek help. Or who, when they seek help, are turned away, who end up in bad situations. And that's going to be as true for the children as it is for the parents. That's as much of my story as I think I can tell in this setting, but I'm happy to answer any questions you have as much as I'm able, and if I don't feel like I can without revealing too much, then I'll just say that. So please feel free to ask.
Well, thank you. That is, I think the theme of today has been preparation before fostering or adopting, during fostering, adopting, and post-fostering, adopting, because if you may be prepared for one of those three sections, it does not necessarily make you prepared for the other two. And the challenge for legislative council and the members of this committee is how to put that into language that we may be able to tweak some statutes that govern it and rules that govern it that will change that. I think you're going to have a change of culture in the adoption community as a big part of it, if not first, because I guess I didn't expect us to come together and to see this many cracks in the cement. But you know, having said that, that's kind of the mission we put forward for ourselves. So, I mean, I'm really glad we're doing this. I feel like this is a topic that's been ignored for far too long. So I'm really glad we're here doing this. With that, I'll ask for questions from the committee. You were very, very thorough, though. Appreciate it. Okay, well, looks like, Oriana, go ahead.
So what do you think would have happened? What would have happened to your son? Because I think that there's been this misunderstanding among adoptive parents who really don't hang in. And even when you have to go to an out-of-home care place, and it's not everybody that is going to full termination disillusion. What would have happened? What would have happened to him? Because we also heard some things about why adoption is, because this stuff happens, adoption's bad, or, and I know that's not what some people were trying to say, but you remained his advocate, so Can you talk about what would have happened had he not had, what do you think would have happened, his course in foster care, without somebody who had the legal obligation to oversee these placements?
Wrong person, you have to be the state.
You mean at which stage? Post-adoption? If they said, we're not doing anything? Let's imagine the county wasn't going to step in.
He would have never adopted, but he was in your home for a while, and it would just remain long-term foster care.
Oh, if he hadn't been adopted at all.
Been the
advocate. Well, I'll say we wouldn't do long-term care in our home because we just had a philosophy that children deserve permanence. But let's say that he was in a home where he was staying in long-term care. I think the problem is you're always on the outside looking in. I mean, our son, and I don't in saying this mean in any way to malign any families that choose to do long-term care. I think that there are lots of reasons why people do that. But our son had been in a situation where he had adopted sibling and was the child in long-term care for 6 years. That was hard, right? Am I part of the family? Am I not part of the family? And ultimately, in his case, he wasn't. Again, that was complicated. But that kind of loss, right? The idea that I always could be set aside, I think is very hard.
That's crazy.
It's different. Now, there may be situations because of resource limitations and the legal arrangements, there's no better solution, but it would seem if we can create more permanence for children, that is certainly what all of us want. We want people who can't just say, forget you. They have to deal with you, whether they like you or not. They're stuck with you, right? And we need that, I think, to grow. So obviously, it can't happen in every case, but I think that permanence has mattered, even though in our family, it has taken an arrangement that does not look traditional in any way. It has been it's very awkward for my younger children, for example. Like, is he my brother? Is he not my brother? I didn't see him until last year. Like, who is this person? It's hard. It's awkward. It's uncomfortable. That's why people don't talk about it. But I still think there is value because our son can say, hey, I have a mom and dad, and I can call them when I'm making a decision or need help, and they're there. And I think it matters.
Jill?
I want to say that, you know, clearly you're tenacious and articulate and committed to him. And I kind of was going where you're going is, if he had not had you and your husband and your family, where would he have been? And I think of the parents who don't go that route, who either bail or find alternative ways to, you know, dispose of their children. That's the part that I get very nervous about, is that.
I think, though, again, I don't want this story to be the Klingles are awesome and other people suck. Right? No, but I'm just saying that there's a danger to that, right? Because the Klingles happen to be really good at navigating systems and getting resources and advocating. Because of being in foster care, right. I went to law school, right? Because I wanted to advocate. That changed my trajectory. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of families who are just as well-intentioned and love their kids just as much, maybe even more than we love ours, who just don't know how to do that.
Right. That's
and
what
it's
saying.
That
it
services,
that
right? It's those services
out.
That matter.
Right.
Because the reality is, I ask myself every day, what would you have done if the county said no? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't ask it every day anymore. I used to. What would you do? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think the answer is, at some point, if I thought that there was no way that my other kids could be safe, like really, truly safe in deep and serious ways, then I would have said, we need to find somebody who can do this, who's not us. And hopefully that would have happened. The problem that I often see is that's not what happens, right? Because the problem isn't the parents. The problem isn't actually the family or even the child per se. The problem is the lack of adequate interventions to deal with children who are deeply wounded and in trauma.
And knowledge
that doesn't change.
Knowledge of access. I mean, knowledge of access, or, you know, those are some of the potential things this committee can charge is the education about access, the knowledge of access that I think a lot of adoptive or foster parents don't know. Mary?
I was just wondering, as far as the therapeutic foster home is concerned, where were you able to link up with that family? Was it through?
DCFS.
Okay.
Right. And our child ended up under a delinquency order, so that was the hook for us.
Got it. And
If not, it would have been a lot harder. We probably would have had to do a CHIPS consent decree, which I was not super excited about.
Mm-hmm. Right. And did that therapy at the foster home specialize in any certain area? Did it come back to attachment or just behavior?
No. So our son actually does not have an attachment disorder. I mean, he was challenged because of his history, but thank heaven did not actually have an attachment disorder. But in fact had some severe abuse that needed to be addressed.
Teresa?
Thanks. So Cecilia, I was hearing sort of what Jill's question was and then your comments earlier. I mean, it sounded like you really needed to advocate with the county though for even to get those services after they were
information alone wouldn't have done it for us.
Yeah, originally they were like, sorry, you've adopted, you need to figure it out.
No, it was okay. A situation that was complex enough, including the fact that we were still licensed foster parents, that everyone agreed some intervention here was appropriate. But once fostering wasn't an issue, right, once we stopped being foster parents, so then it's just our biological children in our home and our adoptive son, then technically, I mean, the county really didn't have to play any role, except what we'd gotten ordered through the delinquency petition. Even then, I think placement was something that had to be constantly renegotiated. And again, thankfully we work, and again, I'm not trying to malign the county because we worked with some great workers, but they're under a lot of constraints and therapeutic care, as you probably know, is not cheap. Right, it's super expensive and there are super limited bed spaces. And so it was a constant reminding. That's right, both of those things are at issue. And so we had to constantly remind, look, here are the needs. They're medical, they're psychological, they're behavioral. Here's the vulnerability. Here's your role and what happened. And all of those together made it possible to keep him in what was supposed to be a 6-month placement for 5 years. That, I think, again, we were the exception to be able to access what we needed.
Sure.
Thank you.
Jacqueline.
I don't have a question, but more so just wanted to say thank you for protecting the privacy and the sensitive matter that your son's an adult experience. I think too often we hear, or I should just speak for myself, I hear from adoptive parents who share so much of their child's history that's not necessarily as the drama and the heroism of everything. And to be able to come and testify and share the important pieces, I think is quite challenging, but very admirable.
Yes. Yeah. They matter, right? I mean, mm-hmm. It's hurting kids who we're dealing with. And and people change, right? Mm-hmm. Like, who you are when you're 13 is not who you are when you're grown. And that's, I think, important. In the moment, when you're a parent dealing with a really traumatized child, it is hard to remember that, right? I have the benefit now of hindsight, going, oh, it all turned out happily ever after. Mm-hmm. It didn't feel like that for a while.
Thank you so much for coming today.
You're welcome.
And I would imagine that when you finish with law school, you'll be advocating in this area.
I teach at the law school now.
Oh, you teach at the law school. You said from class, so I didn't know.
Oh, it's orientation. She's doing orientation.
I stand corrected, Professor. Thank you for coming in. We appreciate
my pleasure.
It very much.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
And thanks very much for our committee members for coming today. I think today was incredibly enlightening. Again, we'll be back on September the 23rd. I'm looking forward to it as our mountain to sift through becomes bigger and bigger. And DCF and the Donaldson Institute will be here. Some of the questions about how this stuff is carried out, DCF should be able to answer for us, I'm hoping. Because that, every time we have somebody testify, it brings up more questions as to, wait a minute, where's that gap? So we'll look forward to it. Everybody have a safe ride home. And yeah, yes?
Can we submit questions ahead of time? Would that be helpful to them if we're asking some specific information or not?
You can. You could submit them to Ledge Council ahead of time, but I mean, I think it's been going.
I just want to put them on the side. They're like, oh, we have to go look that up.
I think, you know, they would appreciate that.
I'm certain Secretary Anderson would appreciate that if we did that. But, and again, if you guys have ideas that, I mean, it's turning the advocacy part of this and the gaps in it into legislation is going to be tricky. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of it is just based on people's own personal advocacy and how many hoops they're willing to jump through, and how to change that legally is going to be tough. But if you have suggestions along those lines, please feel free to submit this stuff to the Margit and Ann, because They're geniuses. They don't talk a lot at these meetings, but trust me, they really run the joint around here. So thank you all for coming.
Will we be meeting here?